Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our study of Christianity for Modern Pagans. We're in the chapter Alienation Lost in the Cosmos. We have a giant pensée with quite a lot of commentary that we've entered into. So we'll have our invocation and prayer. We'll pick up at pensée 199 on page 120. And we'll read up to where we left off just from the beginning. It's not all that far. And then again, apologies in advance. We're going to be doing our page flipping back and forth again, virtually this entire session, if not the whole thing. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. All right, Pascal writes the following. Disproportion of man. Before going on to a wider inquiry concerning nature, I want him to consider nature just once, seriously and at leisure, and to look at himself as well, and judge whether there is any proportion between himself and nature by comparing the two. Let man then contemplate the whole of nature in her full and lofty majesty. Let him turn his gaze away from the lowly objects around him. Let him behold the dazzling light set like an eternal lamp to light up the universe. Let him see the earth as a mere speck compared to the vast orbit described by this star. And let him marvel at finding this vast orbit itself to be no more than the tiniest point compared to that described by the stars revolving in the firmament. But if our eyes stop there, let our imagination proceed further. It will grow weary of conceiving things before nature tires of producing them. The whole visible world is only an imperceptible dot in nature's ample bosom. No idea comes near it. It is no good inflating our conceptions beyond imaginable space. We only bring forth atoms compared to the reality of things. Nature is an infinite sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. We heard the critique last week, I think, of nature being infinite. In short, it is the greatest perceptible mark of God's omnipotence that our imagination should lose itself in that thought. Let man return to himself. Consider what he is in comparison with what exists. Let him regard himself as lost. And from this little dungeon in which he finds himself lodged, I mean the universe, let him learn to take the earth, its realms, its cities, its houses, and himself at their proper value. What is a man in the infinite? But to offer him another prodigy, equally astounding, let him look into the tiniest things he knows. Let a mite show him in its minute body incomparably more minute parts, legs with joints, veins in its legs, blood in the veins, humors in the blood, drops in the humors, vapors in the drops. Let him divide these things still further until he has exhausted his powers of imagination, and let the last thing he comes down to now be the subject of our discourse. He will perhaps think that this is the ultimate of minuteness in nature. I want to show him a new abyss. Okay, well, that brings us into the new material by a little ways and gives us opportunity to flip back and get some commentary. But as you can tell, looking at the forest and not getting lost in the trees, the meditation is on the, in a sense, I don't know how literally he takes this, that the universe is infinite, just more like vast beyond comprehension. And then the imagination of man is even vaster still, or greater still, because you can even imagine like the relatively infinite universe as itself just kind of an atom in a bigger organism and a bigger organ, and so on and so forth, right? And you could do the same thing going all the way down. That's the next. So you just consider even all the way down to the atom, and perhaps the atom is itself a universe, and within that are atoms, and there's universes, and right? So it's just a meditation on heretofore in the Ponce, not only the staggering grandeur of nature from its greatest to its least, but the almost, and in a sense, this paradox that it's infinitely greater than we are, and yet our mind is infinitely greater than it, because we can conceive of these things in all their vastness or all their minuteness with that same infinite scope. Okay, so that's all the more of the point that's really been made heretofore in the Ponce. He's going to go further, obviously. If we flip back to, let's see, maybe we left off around F. Let's shoot for F and see. Yes, so page 128, comment F. I think this is where Kraft might be critical. The clear medieval distinction between the infinity of God and the finitude of the universe is breaking down, even as Orthodox a Christian as Pascal now speaks of the universe as infinite, though not yet of God as infinite. So a little mild critique there. We can drop down to I. The atom, the word atomos in Greek, literally means not divisible, not splittable. That is a unit. Pascal was prophetic in supposing that atoms were not in fact unsplittable. Perhaps the only thing in nature that is truly unsplittable or a true unit is a person. It's an interesting concept. A self, an I. At least by natural power, discounting demonic possession and literal split personalities in hell. Yeah, I don't know what his metaphysical grounding is for this claim. It doesn't seem to be too serious. And then the final comment we got was in regard to, I want to show you a new abyss. So since we're here, we may as well grab hold of Crave's comment. J, the very same abyss of unendingness and unboundedness that we discovered in the universe outside us, we now discover in the universe inside us. The microcosm is as much an infinite abyss as the macrocosm. The essential point here is not the scientific speculation, but the human consequence, the abyss, the bottomless hole into which our thought falls when contemplating these wonders. Okay, and there are these and other kinds of internal abysses that we can fall into. And so, where this is going, it's just this great paradox of man, that man is infinitely smaller than the universe, but his intellect is infinitely greater than the universe. And so we find ourselves in this, and remember, we talked about that distinction between man and God, with man being a sinner and the holy God. That's kind of one distinction. But the other category of distinction is God as creator and we as creature. And that's more in view here, at least heretofore. And the interesting thing about that then is to see how God created man, because it's instructive. Man on the one hand has like this small g godlike capacity within his imagination and mind. And on another hand is bounded almost to the point of being like an ant, this infinitesimally small little creature of dust, right? So this kind of paradoxical nature of humanity is part of the wonder of our creation. And you've probably experienced this yourself. You can have lofty and incredible theological thoughts or emotions of mercy and love and this kind of thing. And then at the same time, like, you've got to fall around fluffy to the park and scoop the poop after she's done, or, you know, scrub the scum off of a bathtub, or, you know, we have this odd paradox about our nature that we do these infinitely humble things but have also this infinite majesty. I'm using that obviously in an exaggeratory way, but you see the point, that God imbues us with this as creatures. Okay, any thoughts you have before we turn back to the pensée? Anything you want to add to that? Yes, sir. We'll get you a microphone here. 1 second.
Yeah, why do you think he says that the only truly unsplittable true unit is a person?
Yeah, I don't think it's all that well grounded. I think... So I think he's trying to say you have some sort of... If I were to try to argue the way I think he might argue, you'd say God is an unsplittable unit and we're made in the image of God, so we're an unsplittable unit in that sense. And here it's very much abstracted just to the self, whatever that means. The scriptures say there's such a thing as a double-minded man. Likewise, we can be split between body and soul. That's the nature of death itself. So that's what I meant by it's not very well metaphysically defined what exactly he's saying or doing here, other than maybe the unique hypostasis or person as a creature, because it bears the image of God, bears a certain kind of indivisibility to its essence. That's the best I could do. Don't ask me to defend it. I don't know. Yes, sir.
Is it? Do the Catholics have any equivalent to the Lutheran doctrine of the old Adam and the new Adam? Could that be?
They have an alternative. Yeah. Their version of. So are you talking about in the converted Christian? What's going on internally there? Right. They would see that. They just diminish it much more than we do. So whereas we talk about a kind of nature sin or person sin that were corrupted in all of our faculties, like and so maybe the best way to understand the Lutheran position is probably to use Paul's inner outer man. With my inner man, he says, I delight in the law of God. Right? The inner man is being renewed day by day. It's the outer man that's perishing. It's the outer man that has this law of sin in its members. And so even as the inner man strives to do that which he wills, the outer man is constantly inhibiting him. The good that I want to do, I do not do. The evil that I don't want to do, that I keep on doing. Who will save me? Christ. But even on deeper analysis, if I agree with the law, if I agree with God what is good, then it is no longer I who sin, but sin that dwells within me. Roman Catholicism doesn't speak in these terms, but talks more as if the sinful nature is a kind of weakness and a kind of tinder. So it's liable to catching fire. It's weak. It's not what it should be. And we would agree with all of that. I mean, in a sense, we would just say you don't go far enough and you're not really articulating the concupiscence, the fallen nature in its opposition to God, a sort of willing opposition to God. And then, you know, to extend that to the Christian ontology, this law of sin at work in my members trying to bring into captivity the law of my mind. Those are the categories Paul's using. So you got this law or power in your mind over and against the law and power of sin at work in your members. Paul talks about this in a number of different ways. But ultimately the answer is we have to be saved from this body of death through death. By Christ Jesus our Lord, as he puts to death that old Adam in us and finally sets us free. Until then, we're contending against it. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you think that they don't go far enough in that line of thought, and it seems to me that that might be somewhat deliberate and not unintentional.
Yeah.
It's deliberate because if they agreed with us, then that eliminates the need for their infrastructure and the rules and all the trappings that they have.
Yeah, right. It really throws a wrench in their whole system. I mean, the Lutheran position on original sin hinges especially on what Paul says, and especially like the verses that I've been articulating, but also that the things of the spirit are at war against the things of the flesh. So they want to look at the flesh as being like weak, maybe kind of a dead anchor against good works, or a kind of tinder that's liable to be set on fire by external temptation. And they'll speak a lot about this weakness, but they don't see it the way Paul sees it, as an as a law or power within us operating contrary to what we want. They don't see it as a full infection. And you're exactly right that in a sense, the whole Reformation can be understood on the basis of the disagreement of that one article. And because if you don't know the disease, or you can't agree on the disease, you're not going to agree on the medicine. You're not going to agree on the extent of, like, are you powerful to heal yourself or not, or participate in your healing or not? And to what extent are you? So, right, it all boils down to, if you don't have the same idea of the disease, you're not going to have the same idea of the cure. And that kind of, like, that's, if that's one side of the coin. Remember, in the Formula of Concord, Article 1 is the original sin, and Article 2 is freedom of the will. Those are two sides of the same coin. So if sin, I mean, they want to uphold this idea of the free will, even in fallen men. And so that necessitates, on the other side of the coin, that you make sin just this kind of tinder or dead weight, so that the will can still be free enough to operate, even though it's somewhat impeded. We just don't see that in St. Paul. We see that the will is contrary to God. God converts the will, and then the will begins to cooperate with God. I mean, the will literally asserts, I believe, in the creed. The will that has been converted and has received the gift of Christ through the preaching of the gospel, faith comes by hearing. This will then begins to cooperate with the Holy Spirit in confessing the faith, in confessing Christ, in doing good works, etc. Okay, any other thoughts? All right, let's jump back into the Pensée, page 121, the bottom paragraph. I want to show him a new abyss. I want to depict to him not only the visible universe, but all the conceivable immensity of nature enclosed in this miniature atom. Let him see there an infinity of universes, each with its firmament, its planets, its earth, in the same proportions as in the visible world. And on that earth, animals, and finally mites, in which he will find again the same results as in the first, and finding the same thing yet again in the others without end or respite, he will be lost in such wonders, as astounding in their minuteness as the others in their amplitude. All right, we're going to press on a little further, because I don't think that's any new ground being covered. We'll grab the comment later. For who will not marvel that our body, a moment ago imperceptible in a universe, itself imperceptible in the bosom of the whole, should now be a colossus, a world, or rather a whole, compared to the nothingness beyond our reach? Anyone who considers himself in this way will be terrified at himself, and seeing his mass as given him by nature, supporting him between these two abysses of infinity and nothingness, will tremble at these marvels. I believe that with his curiosity changing into wonder, he will be more disposed to contemplate them in silence than investigate them with presumption. Okay, and again, this ties into the overarching thesis and theory that Pascal in his apologetic wants to create, that silence by which man is brought into wonder and awe and true contemplation, whereby he can receive the proclamation of the gospel profitably and believe. But this is also, I mean, this is well known in the thinking of the scriptures and the thinking of the church fathers, and this is why this would give you insider window into why it's not inconceivable or intangible to us that the scriptures refer even to human beings as small g gods. We're able to, by God's gift and by God's grace, contemplate these godlike things. And if you're paying attention, I mean, that's effectively what he's saying when he's talking about the fact that you can conceive within your mind of an infinitude of universes scaling up or scaling down, completely connected in myriad ways or patterns according to your internal ability. All of that's contained within you, and then you get done with your meditation in this, you know, godlike state, and you get done with your meditation and you're like, oh, I'm hungry, I'm gonna go make a Hot Pocket. Just, you know, this is what it is to be a human being. It's wild. Wild. All right, but we're creating that silence. That's really what he wants to do, is realize the grandeur and majesty that God has written within us, and then to be silenced in wonder. If we go back to page 129, we can pick up a few of the comments here. I don't know that we need to get all of it. Let's jump down on 129 to the last paragraph there on that page. Neither Pascal nor any contemporary scientist is claiming that this is in fact exactly the case, but such like that an atom would really have a universe attached to it, or a universe like ours. I mean, nobody. That's not the point of the exercise. So, but such fantasy scenarios are truer to the fundamental facts, the human situation vis-a-vis the universe, the disproportion and the consequent stammering terror, than any other cozier picture. The point of Pascal's picture is not scientific, but philosophical. It is not scientifically true, and we are not sure of that, are we? It is nevertheless a true myth, as Tolkien's Lord of the Rings is a far truer tale of the way things really are than libraries of statistics. Okay, so in other words, he's saying, you see the point, don't get bogged down in the details. And I agree, I think that's right. All right, on to point L, and this is an important explanation. Here is the bottom line, the point and purpose of this spectacular pensée. It is not a spectacle, but a moral. Not speculative, but practical. Not about nature, but about man. It is a slap in the face to teach us the wisdom of wonder, silence, and humility. It is not designed to fill our heads, but to bow them. For over three centuries since Pascal wrote these words, our arrogance has become larger than the universe, and our awe smaller and harder to find than an atom. And I mean, you can see that this is the self-consuming disease of the arrogant atheist, who, especially in this kind of quip that, how does it go? I'll have to paraphrase it, but something to the effect of, what we call God is the ever receding lack of human knowledge, right? Or what we call God is just simply that which we don't yet understand. And so God is getting smaller and smaller as man's understanding is getting larger and larger. You can find this in like the New Atheists or Neil deGrasse Tyson. Had a Lutheran moment there and slipped into a crass insult. But these people who set themselves up as, you know, these great minds who are inconceivably smart are just engaged in crass hubris. So I think this is a wonderful thought that Kraft puts forward, that as our arrogance has gotten larger than the universe, so our awe has gotten smaller than an atom. And in fact, it should be the opposite. That, and this is probably something that, you know, we post-Enlightenment, rationalistic Western people need to really take in, that God reveals himself in the book of nature and in the book of Scripture in the first place for awe and wonder and worship. In the second place for knowledge and understanding. To be experienced first and foremost. To be understood insofar as we can and understand in a secondary way. All right, so Kraft continues, even the Nazi-inflicted Holocaust, the fear of a worldwide nuclear and or ecological Holocaust, and the ghastly breakdown of social morality and the family have hardly dented our arrogance. The wonder, contemplation, and silence Pascal calls for are still largely the province of socially marginal flake groups. The bottom line of Pascal's three-century-old fantasy is far more, not less, relevant in our day than it was in his. We have been living in an unstable and temporary situation for three centuries, as if in an airlock or a bridge or a time warp. And Pascal is the first to see it. He is suspended between two worlds, the pre-modern, pre-scientific world in which we have a cosmic place, meaning, and harmony with nature, and the scientific, or rather scientistic, world. And that's the key distinction. That's, and I'm using that same distinction when I talk about quote-unquote science or scientism. So this scientistic worldview, according to which the universe, whether it is a clockwork machine, a drama of the blind will to power, or life force, or a mathematical equation, is inhuman, alien, unfit for habitation, not a home. All right, and then he's going to talk about homelessness as our unstable condition. So why is it that we feel lost in the cosmos? Because we've gotten rid of all the grandeur of human experience and wonder and awe and replaced it with these very narrow tools, which aren't bad insofar as it goes, but if you replace the awe and grandeur and wonder, the revelation of God in creation and in yourself with scientism, then you're going to end up experiencing the feeling of being lost in the cosmos, of no longer recognizing yourself or the world around you, because it is one that is permeated with God. And if you reject or deny God, you're not going to see it as it is. Okay, that's the whole point. Hit the top of 131, and then I'll pause and see if you want to offer any of your own reflections. Pascal does not guide us into either answer because he is not an anthropologist, but an apologist. His eyes are on God, not man, as the standard. He uses our modern alienation from the cosmos not to lead us back to a more human world, nor forward to a brave new world, but to goad us away from the world into the arms of God. So obviously what's meant is not the world as the revelation of God, but the world as a sort of distraction from God, as scientism has made it. So to goad us away from the world into the arms of God, who alone can save us. It is the same strategy as Augustine's in Book 19 of the City of God. Its point is precisely that this world is not my home. Okay. Any thoughts you have heretofore? Yes, there's one.
Thank you. So what it kind of dawns on me that life is special, and it's on a kind of on a sliding scale, that the more in Christianity and everything else, life is really special. It's so special that this is the only place in the universe that has it, as opposed to what we're talking about, in that life is common and it's everywhere in the universe. And it's not as special. Could it? Is
yeah,
that?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's something. I see your point. I think. So I'll just try to restate it in my own words and make sure I'm understanding.
That's what I'm looking for.
Yeah, the science. So this scientific hypothesis.
Yeah.
That the universe must be teeming with life has the effect of causing us to feel even more insignificant and just like mold growing right. on a little planet in the
Worthless.
Corner of nowhere. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, of course, like just ties right into the morality we want to have.
Yeah.
I mean, if I'm an animal, then no one can fault me for acting like one. Or if I'm mold, no one can act, you know, criticize me for acting scummy. So yeah. that seems to be really at the spiritual heart of such theories. Yeah.
Right.
Plus those theories, I mean, yeah, they're also self-defeating even within the own system, because there's no such thing as a universe teeming with life if the universe is separated. I mean, this is by these infinitely distant spaces, right? This is the, what do they call that? The dark woods theory of the universe or something like that. Uh-huh. But it's this idea that, so let's say the whole universe is in fact populated with, you know, millions or billions of planets like ours teeming with life of various degrees of intelligence or whatever. The universe itself is so vast that you would be like a little pocket of life hidden in a dense forest, unable to see, like a little, like sitting by a campfire, right? Unable to see another campfire 100 or 200 yards off because of the density of the forest. So for all it's teeming with life, it does you no good. You're still completely alone and isolated, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and then other problems enter in, of course, too. Like this, we have this idea of like aliens coming and visiting us, which is like they'd have to, in order to leave whatever system they live in and come to us to visit us, they would have had to leave before they knew we existed. You run into all these kinds of logical problems within its own.
Yeah.
So within the quote unquote scientistic worldview itself, there's all these problems and conundrums, and then you start to smell the roast, as they say. That what's really cooking is these moral desires, or rather immoral desires of man, manifesting themselves in scientific theory in order to sound smart or intelligent.
Right.
Right.
You know, you go back to shows like Star Trek. In the 60s, and Gene Roddenberry, the creator of it, you know, I mean, it's like he was kind of putting forth his own agenda in cheapening life by, you know, life is everywhere. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It's an interesting.
But they had great outfits.
I think there's also something, though, we have this fascination with the things outside of ourselves. And so with the scientism, I think that when you deny a God, you end up looking outside of the physical place that you resided into the cosmos, right? Of which you find not much. Because like you said, the visible universe is very small compared to the actual mm-hmm. total distance of creation that we estimate. So... Mm-hmm. I don't know. I feel like it's the natural consequence for looking for something outside of Christ.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Well, and then, I mean, it's interesting. This ties back into the point that was really the main thesis of last session, probably, and that is like this distinction between space and the heavens, right? So it's the same data, but if you believe in God and God's graciousness in Christ, you perceive the heavens. You perceive this fullness and glory and grandeur, and it's like the same infinitude of stars and planets and everything else. You go, that's because God is wonderful and isn't it amazing that he loves us? And then the sort of atheistic or agnostic kind of view takes in the same data and just interprets it in the complete opposite way. It's impossible that a God would exist, or if he does, he doesn't care about us, and he's so far and so distant, and we live in cold, dark emptiness, and we're all going to die heat death, and, you know, on and on, right? So, yeah, it really does bespeak to the fact that there's more than just some sort of neutral, objective observation going on. You either believe in God and perceive the world in light of that faith, or you don't believe in God and you perceive the world in light of your unbelief. One looks like heaven, the other looks like hell. It's kind of wild. Yes, sir.
Touching on the science fiction aspect that Bob mentioned, it seems to me that the drive to for space travel is fueled by making the universe smaller and less of this majestic thing. If you can zap yourself over and you're instantly on another planet billions of light years away with another light force, it doesn't matter that they're billions of light force away because we now have the technology to achieve that. And so I think that's a drive for that, to shrink the world in that sense.
Right. Yeah, there's all kinds of weird drives, like to go establish life on Mars. I mean, to save ourselves, to start new, to start fresh. There's all kinds of like Edenic dreams that are wrapped up in that that desire. So that's fascinating to see. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. You'd rather live in Nebraska than Mars.
Right.
Which that's saying a lot. No, just easy. Sorry, University of Colorado grad. Have to rag on Nebraska. Okay, should we jump back into the Ponce, page 122? I think we got through that top paragraph through the superscript L. Is that right? Okay, good. So let's pick up with the paragraph, "For after all." For after all, what is man in nature? A nothing compared to the infinite, a whole compared to the nothing, a middle point between all and nothing, infinitely remote from an understanding of the extremes, the end of things and their principles are unattainably hidden from him in impenetrable secrecy. Equally incapable of seeing the nothingness from which he emerges and the infinity in which he is engulfed. What else can he do, then, but perceive some semblance of the middle of things, eternally hopeless of knowing either their principles or their end? All things have come out of nothingness and are carried onwards to infinity. Who can follow these astonishing processes? The author of these wonders understands them. No one else can. All right, so again, they're not given for our understanding per se. They're given for our awe, our wonder, and our worship of the one who made such things. And we also start, I mean, we start to realize a fuller anthropology, at least like compared to angels, which have, you know, at least many of them have much greater intellects than we. There's even still things that they can't comprehend about God, because definitionally to comprehend them would be to become God. And so to be a creature is it is to be finite and to be then locked in a finitude that is, aside from, say, like the incarnation, incapable of the infinitude, except maybe to sort of dimly understand it. So we find ourselves then having a better understanding of what it is to be a creature, regardless of nature. And then we understand our unique perspective as a human being of being bridged between the spiritual and material worlds. And even then, like in that very constitution of having a soul and a body, bridging those two gaps, we see ourselves as a kind of bridged creature or a kind of middle creature who's been given this sort of duality. And so, in other words, I mean, this is a tangent to the point being made, but as we come to know God and as we come to know the cosmos, we come to know ourselves in a way that is otherwise impossible. And as I've said before, the only way to know yourself is to first know God and who God says you are, right? Then you start to know, okay, this is what it means to be a man. This is a human being. This is proper anthropology. Okay, let's pick up then. Yeah, so what else can he do, that paragraph, but perceive some semblance of the middle of things? All right, and then we'll drop down to the paragraph where we left off. Because they failed to contemplate these infinities, men have rashly undertaken to probe into nature as if there were some proportion between themselves and her. Strangely enough, they wanted to know the principles of things and go on from there to know everything, inspired by a presumption as infinite as their object. For there can be no doubt that such a plan could not be conceived without infinite presumption or a capacity as infinite as that of nature. When we know better, we understand that since nature has engraved her own image and that of her author on all things, they almost all share her double infinity. Thus we see that all the sciences are infinite in the range of their researches. For who can doubt that mathematics, for instance, has an infinity of infinities of propositions to expound? They are, and that obviously just tangentially is what every Christian holds, is that mathematics, properly speaking, aren't invented but are discovered, and you're discovering the patterns of the mind of God and the logical, rational structures of God, which he desires for us to discover. But then if that's true, these are infinite, so then math scales infinitely. That's okay. They are infinite also in the multiplicity and subtlety of their principles. For anyone can see that those which are supposed to be ultimate do not stand by themselves, but depend on others, which depend on others again, and thus never allow of any finality. And so even there, though he doesn't take it to this level, you certainly could. You could take that back to the skepticism we learned before and see that there's a kind of infinite regress there, or positively just an idea that you could drive knowledge in a lesser and lesser way, just as you could drive it in a greater and greater way. Okay, let's carry on. But we treat as ultimate those which seem so to our reason, as in material things we call a point indivisible when our senses can perceive nothing beyond it, although by its nature it is infinitely divisible. All right, well, you've played these mind games, right? That, I mean, as soon as you define one, is one dividable? Yeah, I mean, you'd have to make some sort of arbitrary rule that's not. Or a point on the page. A single point, and you say, okay, this is a point for my mathematical purpose or equation. But in truth, you could just, do one of these guys, and all of a sudden you're zooming in infinitely into the point, right? And you realize the point's made of infinite points. Okay, so that's just what he's riffing on, just trying to put it in a simple enough way. So he continues, of these two infinites of science, that of greatness is much more obvious, and that is why it has occurred to few people to claim that they know everything. I am going to speak about everything, Democritus used to say. But the infinitely small is much harder to see. The philosophers have much more readily claimed to have reached it, and that is where they have all tripped up. This is the origin of such familiar titles as of the principles of things, of the principles of philosophy, so this is Descartes, and the like, which are really as pretentious, though they do not look it, as this blatant one, of all that can be known. Okay, so, yeah. Man's hubris has been thwarted in every way. And I mean, this is why so much of the scientism, the bombacity, either in greatness or in smallness, is of the most absurd kind. Because even just that simple kind of Humean skepticism devours and eats it up and shows it to be foolish in its own right. Shows it to just be like a lesser religion than even some of the most nonsensical religions of the past. All right, and then the point here is that man in his quote-unquote in stage of enlightenment has actually become darkened, and thinking himself to be, the humble student of nature, he's become so exceedingly puffed up as to think himself a god, while in fact he's just demonstrating that he knows nothing and less than he knew before when he had God. Yes.
This reminds me, when we contemplate the infinite, if we do, it subjects us, it humbles us, because we can't. And I was talking to a Mormon one time, and they said, God can't go against what he's created. So he has to follow the normal way of things that he created. And I said, why? And he said, because that's what it is. And I realized what a simplistic, silly, stupid religion is, because they try to put God in a box by their own constraint. And you can't get past that, because that's all they'll look at, what's possible in their own mind.
Yeah.
And infinite doesn't come up.
Yeah.
I don't know if that
Well, thanks for that reflection. Yeah. How can you believe in a religion that was founded by an angel named Moron? That's great. I mean, the devils have a sense of humor. Okay, any other thoughts? All right, where did we leave off now? I lost myself here. Did we get through 123? Did we get through that footnote N? We did. And then we got another one. Yeah, okay, the absurd, by Pico della Mirandola or whatever that 15th century guy is. Let's jump forward and just get a couple observations here. So page 132, we'll grab a couple thoughts from Crave to at least break up the long stream of thought here from Pascal. So on page 132, if we look up at the first full paragraph, this is going to be a little out of context, but Crave says, "Nor does science tell us about God or of his ultimate purpose and end and design and will for us and our universe. Salvation is not written in the sands, but in the soul." Okay, and so the point of this critique is that the limited scope of science is absurd. I mean, it's absurd for it to claim that it's like unthroned God and is getting at the real heart of the universe and this, that, and the other thing. It can't do any of the above. It can't tell us the purpose and design, God's will for us. It can't tell us any of the things that are the most important things. And so again, we can see the kind of idolatry that takes place in that worldview under the pretenses of like a quest for objective truth or something like that. All right, dropping down to comment N, we'll just pick up at that second larger paragraph where Kraft writes, "Pascal here excoriates both, one, the theoretical rashness of Descartes, who thought he could deduce all the truths of nature from the principles of his philosophy, and two, the practical rashness of technologists like Bacon, who thought that his quote-unquote knowledge for power and quote-unquote man's conquest of nature by the quote-unquote new organon or tool of inductive logic and scientific method would create a new Atlantis." Oh, yeah, we're all living in that, aren't we? "A utopia of wisdom, goodness, happiness, prosperity, and peace." I mean, it's more that like along with the tech, this is a point that Kraft makes regularly. It's more like as technology and prosperity have raised like to the exact same level, has our spiritual and mental well-being decreased? So there's this kind of like obvious trade-off that's happening. And Kraft makes this point in a number of ways and even in some other directions, but that there's no such thing as a free lunch in a fallen world. Well, if you gain in one area, you're going to be losing in another. And obviously we can see what we've sacrificed in going for this sort of boundless use of technology, right?
Yes, sir. Isn't it kind of true that we live in Atlantis? I mean, it ended up underwater, right?
Yeah.
Despite all of their effort. Yeah. So I actually think we got exactly what we asked for, you know?
Yeah. Well, did you like, I should have kept reading, did you like his refutation of the utopia of wisdom, yeah. Goodness? Yeah. One name refutes Bacon, Los Angeles. Right. Avoid that place like the plague if you can, right? Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, it is kind of interesting because obviously the end of the world and the timeline of the world is completely in God's hands. Every generation of Christians is called to expect his days to be the last. When you zoom out at like what's happened over the last 200-300 years of humanity, though, it is just this obscene self-deification, like unthought of, unheard of in the ancient annals of man's perversity, that we would think ourselves to be gods. I mean, ancient peoples would look at us and say, what is wrong with you? But in any case, here we are. Okay, any thoughts you have on these thoughts, on the critique of Bacon or Descartes, or scientism, which is kind of lurking in the background as the enemy. All right, okay, yes, sir. Get your comment, and then we'll jump back into Pascal here.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about Grieftin talking about technology. And we seem to be entering that new age coming from off the Industrial Revolution into the, they call it technocracy. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the epitome of what Grieft is talking about, technology that we're entering into.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to consider what that's going to hold for us. And I keep thinking of the Tower of Babel, mm-hmm. You know, where God had to do something,
yeah,
because of where man was headed,
yeah,
and his craftiness and his atheism,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there's lots of folks, Christian folks, theologically minded folks, who draw connections between the Tower of Babel and what we're seeing happening right now with the sort of globalism and technocracy and these kinds of pushes. Does that thing where it's not the exact reflection or the exact same thing, but it sure rhymes. It sure looks similar, eerily similar, right? You get that uncanny valley of like, wait a minute, is this Babylon 2.0? Yeah. So, right. Right.
How would you define scientism again?
Well, okay, so I would define scientism, what I think about it, I think of what is the scientific method. That limited scope, that subset of reason, which is a way of finding and discovering truths in the world. That scientific method is well and good and a kind of blessing. And like I said, it's a subset of reason, and reason is a gift of God. Scientism departs from that without telling you it's departing from that. And starts making all sorts of wild statements as if they were science, as if they were produced by or derived from the scientific method, when in fact it's not. So it's a kind of leap from a method of reasoning to a religion under the deceit of telling you it's not doing that. So scientism oversteps the bounds of the mere scientific method. That's the most common form of scientism. I suppose another kind of scientism that's just, I don't even know that this is all that popular, is like all we can, it's an epistemological claim, all we can ever claim to know must be verified by the scientific method. I mean, so what is that error but to take the whole scope of human knowledge and understanding and limit it down to this tiny little narrow thing, which came from what? And is self-evident how? That we should be doing this or limiting ourselves in these ways. So, and likewise, then it just doesn't, it also hits an infinite regress when you start probing and questioning the assumptions of like, well, why should that be the case? Or should that be the case now? Should that be the case 1,000 years ago or 1,000 years into the future? How do you know that? And so on and so forth, right? So those are the two forms, one very rare, one very common. I mean, and thankfully we're getting broken of this. This is part of the, I mean, in some sense, the rays of light shining through this Enlightenment nonsense. I mean, what were we all told repeatedly through the experience we had in 2019 and 2020? Trust the science. Trust the science. Okay, well, we trusted the science, and the science showed itself to be untrustworthy. And the people yelling, trust the science, themselves weren't understanding the science, and or were understanding the science, and were just flat out lying to us about the science. And so that in many respects was a huge service to all of us. And you can just see right through it. I mean, and if at that level it exposes itself to be untrustworthy, it's untrustworthy all the way down, right? And then you realize, if you're following this, the quote-unquote science, the scientific method, what studies and experiments are selected to be done? Well, in my naive time on this planet, in this respect, I mean, I'm naive in other ways, but in this respect, I kind of thought that a bunch of scientists were sitting around at universities determining with some sense of objectivity, this is what we want to probe into, this is what we want to study, this is going to be our unbiased methodology, and we're going to further the objective knowledge of humanity. Is that how the world works? That is not how the world works. The world is driven by what? Money. And money determines not only what questions are being asked, what experiments are being done, but what results are being published. And you realize, like, oh, behind the curtain of objective hardcore science is, in fact, this little bald man named Mammon who runs the world. So that's hardly objective either. Yes, sir.
Just in terms of that definition, it's probably helpful to think that observation and empirical evidence are in the category of science. Believing or trusting in what the so-called experts say, that's where you're in scientism.
Yes, right. Right, absolutely. Absolutely. You even find that kind of empiricism, objectivity, that in and of itself suffers from a certain kind of philosophical subjectivism, which, again, these things can be stated over and against religious claims as if they were somehow superior, when in fact, under metaphysical scrutiny, they're not. And so that you know, is just yet another kind of wrinkle or caveat to the discussion. Yes, sir.
I just want to throw in here this magical word of models.
What does it say again?
Models.
Oh, yeah?
Models, yeah.
Yeah?
The scientific models.
Okay, yes. And scientific paradigm shifts.
As ways of describing all things according to this model. It's like garbage in, garbage out kind of thing.
Right.
And then people kind of making those models into new idols. And,
yeah, of course.
And not seeing it as a model, but it's, that's the fact, because that's what the experts say, when in fact the experts say, well, that's the model. And they might say at best, well, we'll, you know, if you show us otherwise, then we'll, but this seems like the best thing.
Yeah.
Models.
Yeah, and no model's ever perfect, or no paradigm is ever complete. There's always unanswerable things which drive you on to the next paradigm or model, scientific paradigm or model.
And then you realize, I mean, I think there's this, I think he's an atheist, Bill Bryson is his name, but he does these popular books. If you read his little short history on everything or whatever that title is, I mean, I just remember that in my mind because I was absolutely stunned. Like, without shame, he just, because he's talking about this like with religious fervor, the scientific progress that's been made and the paradigms that have, you know, shifted and the new models that have come. And there's just, but he, like, utterly lost on him, apparently, is the fact that if you at any point in time in the past said, I believe in this and not the Bible, within 100 years, the this that you believed in would be completely debunked and shown to be utter nonsense. So, like, that is wild, because whatever the quote-unquote science is now that everybody is so certain of, and, you know, well, we, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity and this, that, and the other thing. I mean, there's already so many holes in that that we know something else is coming in the future. But these poor people who lock onto this as if, like, well, this is what the science says, and I am enlightened and intelligent, and God's word in the book of Genesis, bah, I'm going to set my feet on this solid ground of science, are within 50 years shown to be utter fools. And another 50 years, those people are shown to be utter fools. And another 50 years, the same. Definitionally, I mean practically, what Christ would call shifting sand. It just shifts right under your feet from one thing to the next thing, and he tells us to build our houses upon the rock, the solid rock of his word, that we not be hearers only but doers also. And so to build our house on the solid rock of God's own revelation and the epistemology of God's revelation proves to be that rock that weathers every storm, whereas science doesn't even weather the storm of time, because within a few decades or sometimes less, the entire landscape has shifted to a foundation that's altogether different. Yes, sir.
I think it goes beyond science. It goes to the general trust the experts. And
yeah,
I think of history as one good example where a lot of kids in school and college aren't given primary sources to scrutinize, but rather they have a history book that's a paraphrase by so-called historical experts.
Yeah.
with only excerpts of the primary sources.
Yeah.
Selectively given to them to study to make the expert's point.
Yeah, that drive back into the sources, as it were, that we've had even since the late medieval period is a helpful one, and gets us away from that credentialism or expertism. Yes, sir.
Yeah, when we're looking for that solid rock of Christ on which to stand, we just need to make sure that it isn't a sham rock.
A what now?
Sham rock.
A sham rock, yes. Nice, I see what you did there. Nice, nice. How can we end but there on that great note? All right, let's next week, I'm not going to like say we're going to get any further than I've already said we're going to get, because we're working our way through this big, huge Ponce, and it looks like we're going to continue to next week. The Lord be with you.